What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Bama Beat podcast brought to you by Wickles Pickles and Home Field Apparel. I am Brett Hudson, and I'm joined, as always, by Clint Lamb. Clint, are you enjoying the little bit of posts, or I guess off-season, that we've had thus far, although coaches and players are constantly leaving, so it's not really off as much as it's non-game season?
You know, I kept telling people, you know, once the season's over, my schedule is really going to free up. I'm still going to be busy, of course. I do a lot more than just cover Alabama football nowadays, but it's going to really lighten up. I was very wrong, and I don't see it really getting any better anytime soon, just because you got to think, man, Alabama football is kind of 365, right? There's always players to be looking at as far as who's returning, coaches are leaving, looking at the roster that way. Then you got NFL draft preparation, tons of Alabama players. I'm going down to the Senior Bowl next week. You know, so that's just another trip and somewhere else I got to be. And then after that, you start talking about combines, which even though they just announced they were changing up the combine formula this year. But then after that, you got spring ball, you got the actual NFL draft. It's just like, it's year round, man. But at the same time, I'm enjoying it. I miss college football. I guess it's kind of, it is our lives in a lot of ways. So I guess that makes sense. But we are going to get some FCS football relatively soon. So it's going to be a different kind of offseason, and I'm kind of looking forward to it.
That I look forward to. So the FCS football in the spring. I fear that I'm going to get used to it. Yep. And then when it's not that way in perpetuity, I'm not going to know what to do with my hands. At least I have college baseball. Anyway. we're going to kind of wrap up the year on sort of a macro level, like the legacy of the team and some of the obvious comparisons that a season like that brings about to some of the recent great national championship teams, and obviously the two dynastic coaches in Alabama's football history, Nick Saban and Bear Bryant. Then we're going to get to a podcast later in the week where we look at the roster turnover and the coach turnover now that is starting to take shape a little bit. There are a few decisions that could break one way or another, more from a player side than a coach side. But we'll kind of look into that and then in a future podcast later this week. And I would imagine we'll get even more into that when some of these widely reported coaching replacements become official. We'll get to all that later on in the offseason. But before we get to today's topic, we have to let you know that Home Field Apparel just dropped BYU gear that is incredible. I'm looking at a hoodie and a blue t-shirt that have both the cartoon cougar type mascot with the sailor hat on that is so, so good. And one of them, the cougar, is like super buff with his arms folded in front of him, like he's looking at you from across the bar, hitting on your girlfriend, you know? Fantastic look for BYU stuff on Home Field Apparel. And yes, they have Alabama gear. 13 pieces of Alabama gear, along with stuff from over 100 other colleges on homefieldapparel.com. It is licensed, unique, collegiate apparel on some of the most comfortable hoodies, t-shirts, and sweatshirts that you will ever own. You can get 20% off your first purchase with the promo code BAMABEAT. That applies to Alabama gear and all others. If you're shopping for yourself as a Bama fan and shopping for others, be it if you live in a house divided or if you're shopping for families, birthdays, whatever. You know, I've actually got to go to a wedding shower in like a month. I might just take the bride and groom a piece of Home Field Apparel as their wedding gift. They could probably do worse. Homefieldapparel.com is where you can search all of their products. So, Clint, the way I see it, we have three general agenda points here. You may remember, and listeners may remember, back in the preseason, we did an episode that was more or less just preseason predictions. I put together a bunch of questions or predictions for us to make. I put down all of our answers, and we will revisit those to see how right or how wrong we were. We will look at the Nick Saban versus Bear Bryant comparison. I did a somewhat deep numbers dive on that the other day. And we will also look at some comparisons between the 2019 LSU team and the 2020 Alabama team, along with some of the basic legacy of both. So where should we start, Clint?
We should start with Dan Patrick saying that Tennessee was handing out money in McDonald's bags and they're thinking about hiring Jason Witten as their next head coach. I don't know what's going on in Knoxville, but I had to get that on the podcast. When you started talking about going to weddings and getting presents for people and stuff, I was like, as long as they're not Tennessee fans, because if they're Tennessee fans, you might just need to go somewhere other than, you know, the Big Orange as far as presents are concerned. But I don't know how Jason Witten could possibly go from being an NFL tight end for the Las Vegas Raiders to a month later being the head coach of a Power 5 program, an SEC major Power 5 program. But, you know, it's 2021. You know, the line used to be it's 2020. All things are possible. And it looks like it's continuing to transition into 2021. So,
Primetime is the coach at Jackson State.
That's a great point. 2020 brought us Deion Sanders at Jackson State. So at this point, let's just get crazy, man. And I'll give Deion Sanders credit that he's got them at least recruiting really well, bringing in a lot of transfers.
Yeah, dude's pulling four-star recruits to an HBCU.
Yeah, he even had a four-star player flip from Georgia. So I got a feeling that Jason Witten doesn't bring the same type of personality that's going to be very, going to be able to recruit at that level. But he was phenomenal in the booth. That was a very seamless transition. Nobody criticized Jason Witten over that career move. So good. I'm sure that this whole thing, if he ends up being the head coach of Tennessee, will go very flawlessly.
I assumed that Jason Witten would be the offensive coordinator for John Gruden as the head coach.
There you go. See, now you're talking. Now we're building the dream team here. And then you get Rod Mayo.
Andy is your quarterback's coach. T. Martin as an offensive analyst. Eric Berry's your defensive coordinator.
Let's get Eric Ainge back in there.
Yeah.
Let's get the band back together, man.
Yeah, like Eric Ainge is the Tino Sunseri of the Tennessee staff.
Bingo. See, yeah. I like where your head's at.
Yeah.
I like where your
head's at. Yeah, go Vols. Let's do the preseason predictions, shall
yes.
we?
What I need you to do real quick before we do this is I need you to look at that list very quickly. And do I sound smart by looking at the list? If I don't, then we're not doing
it. There's some hits and misses for both of us.
Okay.
There's some hits and misses for both of us. I think I hit more frequently than you did.
Yep.
But there are some pretty big swings and misses from yours truly on here. So let's go ahead and dive in. So I'm doing the counting as I go right here. There were 10/11 predictions that I forced us to make in the preseason. Let's run through these and see how we did. Offensive MVP. We both picked Najee Harris. I think in hindsight, it was pretty clearly Devontae Smith, right?
Yeah, that's not fair. They're all MVPs. But you're right. Yes.
Are they all champions of life, to go back to the Knoxville motif?
Najee Harris in any other season, if he didn't have Devontae Smith just wrecking opposing defenses all year, he's not only winning the Heisman, he's winning MVP of this squad. But you are correct. If you know, based off of how the things actually transpired, then we were ultimately wrong on that. But I don't think it was a bad guess. At least he lived up to that hype. We just didn't know there was going to be somebody else who did even better things.
So one of my notes on my prediction for Najee, basically my explanation, was I thought this team was going to be a little run forward. Yikes.
Well, yeah, I just remember us talking about the possibility that Mac Jones, and we were both Team Mac, by the way, don't want to put this out there, but we did acknowledge that it was possible that, you know, Bryce Young could at some point maybe take over for Mac Jones. We at least acknowledged it as a possibility, not that we thought that it was necessarily going to happen, but we were very wrong on that too. So,
yeah. What I did get right on this was I did call bull from the start on Sarkisian's claim that he's going to rotate running backs more this year.
You did.
And that ended up working in my favor. Najee took 251 carries and B-Rob got 91.
Great call.
I called bull on that from the start, and I was right. It was actually worse, quotations worse. There was less rotation in 2020 when there was in 2019. In 2019, Najee had 209 carries to B-Rob's 96. So from 2019 to 2020, B-Rob lost 5 carries, but Najee gained like 40.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, but great call with that, because there was a part of me that was like, man, Brian Robinson doesn't return if he doesn't, you know, plan to fully be a part of the offense. People were talking about him getting passed up. You know, Trey Sanders, I would be very curious to see how things would have shook out had he continued to kind of get a larger role as far as Brian Robinson is concerned. Now, granted, Brian Robinson has the opportunity to come back. Do we know anything definitively on him?
Yeah, he's one of those that I mentioned earlier. Like when I kind of vaguely said there are a few decisions that could go for or against Bama, he's absolutely at the top of that list. And this is, I mean, we could probably spend like the entirety of the Thursday podcast on the immediate future of Alabama's running back position. But like Brian Robinson Jr. is on that list. Landon Dickerson is on that list. LeBrian Ray, maybe. Seniors that could, or redshirt juniors in LeBrian's case, that could come back and have an impact because of the eligibility waiver. And Chris Owens is already capitalized on that. He's already said that he's coming back to Alabama. So
big return.
Yeah, that's big. And again, we'll dive into all of that on Thursday, or a podcast that we record on Thursday. So offensive MVP, we both picked Najee. We both kind of swung and missed on that one with an asterisk attached that it's not our fault that Smitty did what he did. Defensive MVP, we both took Dylan Moses.
Oof.
I don't see, this is a tricky one. Like, I think we would all agree, you, I, and listener alike, that Dylan Moses was not the defensive MVP, but who do you think was? Is it Surtain? Is it, I mean, would it be Will
Barmore
Jr.? Like Barmore, Malachi Moore, maybe?
Man, that's a great point. Nobody really stood out to the enough above the rest. Not that guys didn't stand out, just relative to a few more guys. There's probably several, but with the way that Christian Barmore finished in those playoff games, especially, now it's a season long award, but if you finish strong and that's the lasting impression that you leave, I would probably say him. But you know, you're right though. There's nobody really that stands out definitively over anybody else.
Yeah. So I think we both agree that Dylan Moses was not the defensive MVP.
Yes.
But I don't know who would be. If gun to head, I would probably lean Surtain. But I'm open to Barmore or others. Offensive breakout player. You had Evan Neal. I had Mac Jones.
Ooh. Ooh.
I feel like that's a win for me.
Yeah, I would say so, man.
Neal had a really good year. He did. But the other tackle won the Outland, and his center won the Remington. He was part of a Joe Moore Award winning offensive line, so a good 100%. Year.
You literally picked the guy that went from potentially getting benched by a true freshman to finishing third in the Heisman race. You 100% win that.
Well, I think you 100% win the defensive breakout player of the year, because you had Jordan Battle. I had Josh Jobe. Ooh. Jobe had a good year, pretty similar to the offensive breakout player. Like, Jobe had a good year, but I thought Battle was borderline awesome this year.
He was good. And what's weird is that people, I don't feel like Alabama fans realized that he was very solid this year.
Dude, I tweeted the same thing. I think it was in the semifinal. He does not get enough credit for what he did back there this year.
He provided a lot of stability at a position. You know, you had guys there was some inexperience. There was guys missing tackles. And so, you know, yeah, I agree with that. Now, I also think Josh Jobe.
When did Battle get bombed on this year?
Oh, I mean, nothing off the top of my head.
There's probably one or two throws in the Ole Miss game, because everybody got bombed on against Ole Miss. But like, other than that, I'm struggling to think of a play where Bama gave up a big play, and there's Jordan Battle like 7 yards away from where he's supposed to be.
Yeah, that's a great point. I feel like breakout really, that's tough. You know who I wish I would have gone with? Because I feel like he had, well, I mean, yeah, even though I remember my thought process thinking, okay, I know that I'm pretty sure I put Will Anderson in another spot. So I was like, I kind of want to go with, but Christian Harris, man. I thought that with the fact that Dylan Moses didn't quite live up to the standard that many had thought, I feel like that Christian Harris did a fantastic job of stepping up and being that guy, both against the pass and against the run, and being an impactful player. Now, he didn't get the recognition from a name standpoint that maybe other guys did, but I thought he had a fantastic season. So,
newcomer of the year. You had Brian Branch. I had Will Anderson.
Oh, that's back when I thought that Brian Branch. Man, how crazy is that, by the way? You know, all this camp hype, even though we were hearing about Malachi Moore, the camp hype was Brian Branch being the true freshman starter at star. And Brian Branch had a good year, by the way, just in very limited snaps. He was more of a rotational player. But Malachi Moore, he
became the guy in the college football playoff when Malachi got hurt.
Yeah, and he did a fantastic. I mean, granted, there were some freshman mistakes, and he was going to get some pretty good players. So you can't really blame him for that. But just the fact that Malachi Moore right there at the last second kind of overtook the starting job. And not only did that, it wasn't like he just kind of went out in a battle and then turned around and had a good season. He was borderline elite, really, from the jump. So I would be, if anybody predicted Malachi Moore for any sort of award based off of what we were hearing out of camp, and that's the difficult part. You only get so much when you're able to go to practice, too. It's not like you get to watch the entire practice. You can see what's happening. But, you know, this year was a lot more reliant on camp reports, and that made things more difficult. But you picking Will Anderson, perfect candidate, worked out to a T. You were 100% correct.
Well, I think you did the next category even better. Team leader in sacks. You had Will Anderson. He finished second on the team in sacks, only one sack behind world record Christian Barmore. So you did pretty good on that one. There were 12 people who got sacks for Alabama this year. I picked the guy who finished 12th, LeBrian Ray.
Okay. I still say that's a little unfair.
Well, I see both sides. Like, yes, LeBrian was hurt for most of the year. Sucks. It is what it is. But even when he was healthy, he wasn't playing, like, great.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't playing like Barmore or Anderson. That's fair.
So I missed it, but with a little bit of a caveat there.
Yeah.
Are punting and kicking any good? I said that the kicking would be good and the punting would be better. And you more or less agreed with that. So the kicking was not good. It was great. Elite. It was amazing. The punting, was it better?
No.
I'm not sure that it was.
No, the punting was no. The kicking was far and away better.
Yeah. So I said kicking good, punting better. What actually happened was kicking, best in the country. Punting, more or less the same, possibly a little worse, because Ty Perrine averaged almost 45 yards per punt last year, whereas this year's savior, Charlie Scott, averaged 39 yards per punt. So if anything, it was actually a little bit worse. So there's another swing and a miss for your friendly neighborhood podcast hosts.
hey, we got to take the losses too, I guess. I have a lot more of them than you do so far. So,
trust me, there is the final real category is epic swings and misses for both of us. But to build up to that one, strongest position on the team.
Oh, I know exactly inside, what I said. Yep.
You said inside linebacker.
Wrong.
I think you would agree that did not come to pass.
Yes.
I said offensive line.
I feel like collectively
it was
now
really good. Was it better than the wide receiving core?
Oh man, maybe it's because there's more impactful positions with the offensive line, and the fact that you had Chris Owens step up for Landon Dickerson and he provided quality play. Don't think he quite played up to the standard that some people have kind of painted. Some people have said that there was zero drop off. There was absolutely some drop off. Alabama did some different things to kind of mask it a little bit, but he still played very well, well enough where you can say, okay, that's six offensive linemen that were pretty impactful players for Alabama this year. Yeah, that's so tough, man. Joe Moore, award-winning offensive line. That's more of a collective thing. You got the one Heisman Trophy winner. Jalen Waddle probably would have prevented Devontae from winning the Heisman if he doesn't get hurt. And the fact that he got hurt and missed a significant portion of the year, that kind of moves John Metchie into the two role. And you got an elite one and two. I wouldn't maybe say that Metchie's elite necessarily right now, but just a fantastic number two. I would say offensive line was probably the strongest position unit. I'm going to give you that one.
If you'll give me the win, I'll take it. I think it's hard to – I guess you could say quarterback, right? Because now Mac has won all three major quarterbacking awards. He already had the Unitas. He already had the O'Brien. He won the Manning Award about half an hour before we started recording.
Well,
you could make that argument, but if you're going for a position group as opposed to a position,
exactly,
I think it has to be either offensive line or wide receiver. If you want to argue for one or the other, I'm cool with it.
The fact that you had Jalen Waddle get hurt, that opened the door for a guy like Devontae Smith to win a ton of these awards. Not saying that he's not an elite player, it's just he was afforded more opportunities. It was more consistently the main part of Alabama's offensive game plan. But you're talking about, not only did your collective offensive line unit win the Joe Moore Award, you had individual guys proving that they were the best at their positions, the best tackle in the country, the best center in the country, or interior offensive lineman, however you want to put it. And so for that reason, I do really think that it is the offensive line. I feel very good about that. You got multiple first round picks, in my opinion, or at least day one or day two picks future. I think Evan Neal's a first rounder. So I feel pretty good about saying, even though the receivers were fantastic, if Jalen Waddle doesn't get hurt, even if Devontae Smith doesn't win all those awards, if he just continues to play like that we know he's kind of capable of, even if his numbers would have taken a hit, we could have said, okay, they're three deep with three really good guys. That would have been a much bigger conversation. But for me, just the entire season, I got to go with the offensive line. So good call on that one.
First team All-Americans. You said seven. I said four. The answer was six. And not only did you get closer to the number, you almost nailed the exact guys that did it. So you said Najee, Devontae, Alex Leatherwood, and another offensive lineman would be first team All-Americans. All of them did it. Najee did it. Devontae did it. Alex Leatherwood did it. And Landon Dickerson was the other offensive lineman that did it. You said Dylan Moses and Patrick Surtain would do it. Surtain did it. Dylan Moses did not. So if you replace Dylan Moses with Mac Jones, not only did you get the correct number of first team All-Americans, you also got the right guys to do it. So you nailed that one. I took a more conservative approach, not knowing that we were possibly going to cover one of the best college football teams in its 151-year history. You went the aggressive route, and you just nailed it.
Yeah, I got fairly lucky, I feel like, on that. But I continue to reiterate, man, just the job that Mac Jones did this year. Imagine being first team All-American quarterback and finishing third in the Heisman. Going in, you know, Zach Wilson wasn't really a thought at BYU, but with what was returning, it was like, it's going to be Trevor Lawrence or it's going to be Justin Fields. You know, once the Big Ten announced they were going to be playing the season, even with them playing less games, people were like, you know, it's going to be one of those two guys. And not only did Mac finish as the highest in the Heisman Trophy race, he finished first team All-American with all the other competition, as far as, you know, people pointing to, you know, the fact that he was surrounded by so much talent. And some people use that as an argument to take away from him. A lot of people probably would have pushed for Trevor Lawrence, or you feel like they would have. The fact that he still won it just, you know, hats off to him for being a first-team All-American, finishing third in the Heisman, doing everything that he did despite an entire offseason of people not only saying that they were or predicting that you were going to lose your job, but wanting you to lose your job. There was a significant portion of people who didn't feel like that he should be the guy. And I'll give my brother a lot of credit because I want to say it was right after the Michigan game. Him and I were talking, and we don't really talk football a ton. You know, we do. He does daily fantasy and stuff like that, but not from a, you know, just kind of breaking anything down necessarily. Sure. But he made the statement. He's like, I already feel like that Mac Jones is the second best quarterback in Alabama history. And I was like, wait a minute, in the Nick Saban era. And I was like, Two is obviously number one. Are you telling me that you feel like that Mac Jones is better than AJ McCarron? He's like, I honestly do. And I was like, dude, that is way too premature. Like, I'm a big Mac Jones fan, but you're pushing this way too far in the other direction. And my brother, he knows football, but he doesn't, you know, he doesn't know it like I feel like I know it, but just crushed that call. So I got to give him props for that too.
And the last one, bounce back player. Do you remember who you picked?
It had to be Dylan Moses.
No.
Ooh, bounce back player. Maybe LeBron Ray?
No. If it helps, you get to pick a player.
Oh, Pete Golding.
Yes.
I pivoted there. I don't know how I feel. You know, I feel like that's kind of a win. In a way, even though a lot of Alabama fans disagree.
Oh, dude, people are going to burn your house down.
Yeah. I'd feel like, you know, I probably need a witness protection.
I would if I were you.
Yeah, but I feel pretty good about the prediction, even though, because he did bounce back from, I thought that he improved a lot this past year. I had a lot more available to him, granted, but who did you go with?
DJ Dale.
Okay. I
don't feel good about that.
I've been on board with so many of your things, but that's one of them that I feel like was a mess.
No, I just ran that one. I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
Who would be the bounce back player on this year's team?
So it wouldn't be Dylan Moses, and Dylan Moses has reasons. I don't want to act like that's right. That's not a thing. As far as bounce back goes,
I'm struggling to think of one.
Yeah, nobody that really struggled. And then maybe Josh Jobe. He was supposed to be the starter last year, got benched after the Duke game, kind of battled back, ended up being the starter against Michigan. They targeted him early, and he did some pretty good things, and then takes over as the full-time starter this year and has a very solid season playing off. I mean, you got to understand, a lot of people were like, that's going to be the guy we're going after. We're going to try to avoid Pat Surtain. And that doesn't mean that they didn't target Pat Surtain at all, but it's just, you know, pick your poison. A lot of times it was going to be Jobe, and I feel like Jobe had a good year, so maybe Jobe.
I might could make a case for Miller Forrestall. He had that throat injury that kept him out of the final four regular season games last year, and he came back this year and what was probably one of Alabama's better tight end receiving threats until they handed it over to the greatest tight end to ever play football, Jaleel Billingsley. But then he also kind of developed as a run blocker. I wouldn't say he was a good run blocker, but he was a better run blocker than what he had been in his career. So that was a big step for him, one that was kind of years in the making for him, being the guy that played mostly quarterback in high school and transitioning to the position. So I guess Miller, maybe.
Okay, let's go ahead and do this. Let's go with the guy that only converted 57.1% of his field goal attempts last year, gets hurt last year, and then comes back and doesn't miss a single kick or an extra point or a single kick. Let's go with that.
Yeah, that's the answer, Will.
Yeah.
That's the answer, Reichard. Yeah.
Yeah. Will Reichard, 100%, give him a lot of credit. Alabama fans certainly appreciate him. I don't think the rest of the country really does, but anybody that's been watching Alabama football or has any emotional investment in Alabama football, and you remember every single one of those missed kicks, you understand the importance of Will Reichard. So huge bounce back year for him in year two.
That's a good one. Yeah. Two categories that we picked, but I don't think we ever, in hindsight, assigned a player to these were defensive breakout player and newcomer of the year. They're kind of tough. If nothing else, because they could both end up being the same person. Like, you could make a case for Malachi Moore for both of them. You could make a case for Will Anderson for both of them. Christian Barmore would obviously be a good defensive breakout player of the year candidate. Where do we fall on defensive breakout player and newcomer of the year now that we've already seen the season?
Newcomer of the year, it's going to either be Malachi Moore or Will Anderson. Tim Smith didn't get
which one you pick.
Say what?
It doesn't really matter which one you pick. It can be personal preference.
Yeah, it really can. Like, I wouldn't be super upset if you went with either of those guys. I think they're both worthy. And I think Tim Smith would have been involved in that, but he just didn't get the same level of opportunities. But I really like that threesome there defensively. Has me really excited about Alabama's defense moving forward. But as far as breakout candidate, who would you say? So many. Jaleel Billings, they could probably count. John Metch, you could probably count. Mac Jones taking that next step and becoming that guy would probably count. Christian Barmore becoming a lot more consistent. Christian Harris taking the next step. There's just so many guys. And Will Reichard, that's another area that he could probably – no, was it defensive breakout?
No, just – well, defensive breakout and newcomer of the year.
Okay, so this was defensive breakout.
The offensive breakout player of the year was obviously Jaleel Billingsley, the greatest tight end to ever play college football. there were a lot of options there.
Ooh.
Mac on the offensive side.
Yeah.
That was not in the preseason. Anyway, defensive breakout player. It's one of Barmore, Anderson, or Malachi Moore. Really, I don't know that I'm going to go against any of them.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, and you know what? Though I feel like the Christopher Allen had a pretty big breakout year, too. Maybe not from a sacks perspective, That's but true. A lot of tackles for loss.
Tackles for a loss. There's something to be said for that.
Yeah, and I only finished two sacks behind the other guys. A lot of breakout candidates, a lot of them. So I don't think you can go wrong with the several guys.
Fair enough. On the other side of the break, I'll give Clint a fake name, first of all, so y'all don't burn his house down for praising Pete Golding. But we'll also get to some bigger legacy aspects of this thing, like comparing 19 LSU to 20 Bama and comparing Nick Saban to Bear Bryant. We'll do that on the other side of the break on the Bama Beat podcast. And we're back on the Bama Beat podcast, brought to you by Homefield Apparel and Wickles Pickles. Y'all already know about Wickles. It's a family recipe for pickles, relishes, okras, and much more that is 90 years in the making right here in the state of Alabama. You can go to wicklespickles.com to learn more about all of their products. I think one of many things that I'm excited about in getting the baseball podcast started up pretty soon is getting back into the Wickles culinary kitchen with Hunter and Hunter Johnson, and also bribing Brad Bohannon with a jar of Wickles to come on our podcast. Wicklespickles.com to learn more about all their products. Hopefully you can find them on the pickle aisle of your local store. Wickles Pickles, let's get wicked. So I've done a little bit of diving in on both of these comparisons, on Nick Saban to Bear Bryant and LSU last year to Alabama this year. So let's start with LSU last year and Bama this year, because I think this is something where the two of us looking at things differently can kind of bring different perspectives. You're probably more well-tooled to look at the individual teams, like the position by position and how they might match up with each other if you were able to pit them on the field at the same time. But if you're looking at it in terms of just greatness, not who would beat who, but just greatness, the case for this year's Alabama team is ironclad. This is the only team in college football history, again, 151 seasons of it, the only team in college football history to win a national championship going at least 13-0 with all of those games against Power 5 competition. The only one to ever do it. They won 8 of those 13 games by at least 28 points. Last year, LSU only won 7 of its 15 games by that margin, and 3 of those wins came in non-conference games against Georgia Southern, Northwestern State, and Utah State. Alabama obviously did not have that luxury, and there are also some SEC layups in LSU's schedule. They had that they had that Vandy game last year, and Bama didn't really get that in its East crossovers this year, although maybe Tennessee, who knows. There was also the non-conference game against Texas, which was solid for LSU last year, but not quite up to some of the competition that Alabama faced this year. So while Alabama's resume and their list of accomplishments probably puts them in more of an apt conversation with some of the great national championship teams from the 60s, 70s, and 80s in terms of strength of schedule and overall dominance in that regard. But naturally, since we've seen two of probably the top 10 college football teams of all time in the last 2 years, in 2019 LSU and 2020 Bama, that's going to be the natural comparison. And I imagine it's been something that's been discussed somewhat regularly, be it among callers or on your with your co-host on your radio show over the last probably couple weeks or so. So where do you fall on the 2019 LSU versus 2020 Bama debate?
I think that when you talk about all-time great teams, and really it's when you try to compare the greatest of all time really in anything, it's a Michael Jordan, LeBron James type of debate a lot of times. Like if you were to try to compare like the 2001 Miami Hurricanes team to either 2019 LSU or 2020 Alabama, it's a different era. It's a different time. I think that Alabama or LSU would absolutely school that Miami Hurricanes team. Reason being is defensively, they just weren't used to going against the style of offenses we see, and they would be completely, confused. It's like putting LeBron James back in the Michael Jordan era with all, with the way that the game was built around the center, position rather than, guys, point guards and things like that. And now you need to have the five that can step out and hit the three or stretch five or whatever you want to call it, or say stretch four. It's like it's a different era. But when it comes to Alabama and LSU, it's a lot easier to compare because it's literally a year apart. And so that's, I've kind of tried to ask myself, okay, from what they achieved, it's like, it's tough to go against Alabama. I mean, we don't know how LSU would have dealt with COVID-19, right? We know that this year's LSU squad that was not nearly as motivated, didn't have nearly as much leadership. They kind of struggle with it. They multiple times. But if they would have been a lot more involved in the conversation for a national championship like they were last year, maybe they stay a lot more, clean and make sure that they're doing the things they need to do to try to win a championship. But at the same time, Alabama had to deal with that. That is a huge obstacle to overcome. And they did not only, in my opinion, were they super disciplined on the field, it took a ton of discipline off the field too. And so it was constantly, you were having to try to be in, you were in football mode, even though it didn't necessarily have to do with anything with football related. Because even when you're at your apartment or your dorm or whatever, it's like you want to go grab some food real quick from the cap, but you're like, man, if I get around other people, that's not good. I can't do that. So it's like that constant stress for a very an extended period of time, on top of trying to manage all these other things. As far as being a college student, you got classes, you got practice, weightlifting, meetings, film study. So it's just, I give Alabama a ton of props for the fact that not only did they go undefeated, not only did they have all these award winners, they beat nothing but Power 5 opponents, including 10 SEC opponents. They also, you know, were able to stay relatively clean all year as far as having COVID-19 outbreaks. They had a couple of guys, of course, Nick Saban got it. So it wasn't like they were perfect, but just compared to a lot of other teams, they did a very good job. You know, Ohio State, they struggled to manage it all year long. They played in the national championship. In fact, that kind of gave them a hit in the national championship. They had guys missing because of COVID-19. So it's just, I think that from that aspect, being able to achieve that with that extra obstacle is pretty special. But then I try to ask myself, because you can't directly relate it, because you go back to that Miami Hurricanes aspect. It's like, okay, would you have given them a week to prepare before they play? Because in that case, yeah, absolutely. I think Alabama or LSU would slaughter them. But if they had a whole season of kind of adjusting to playing that style of offense, that kind of football, the athletes they had would maybe be able to overcome and, you know, whatever. But I thinking about Alabama lining up against LSU, those two squads, who would I think would actually win? That's where things become super difficult for me. Super difficult. Joe Burrow, what he was defensively, Alabama actually had a pretty good game plan against him with guys like Terrell Lewis and Anthony Jennings. They applied pressure. Joe Burrow just kept making play after play after play. And the Alabama offense, does Mac Jones make those, you know, uncharacteristic mistakes like Tua made, which was also uncharacteristic for him, you know, throwing the interception right before halftime, allowing them to add that touchdown, just different things that the random drop on the first drive of the game, after they had gotten a solid drive down the field, I couldn't answer that. So I don't think that I have a definitive answer. Would you say that you have one in particular that you would say, okay, I'll lean this way?
I don't know that you could do one over the other definitively. That would be the two defenses. Like, the two offenses were what they were in historical context. I mean, they did things that had not been done in college football before they came around. So the offenses, you're kind of splitting hairs. It's the defensive side of things that's challenging, because yes, Bama's defense got better over the course of the season, and they ended it with that game against Ohio State that is arguably their best performance of their season. So that's a feather in their cap. But as we mentioned, kind of going down the stretch, there was reason to be skeptical of that defensive improvement in the SEC championship game against Florida, kind of exposed the reasons for that skepticism. Whereas LSU, they also did not start their season well defensively, but they got better over the course of the season in ways that were more undeniable, I guess, like especially in their playoff run, where they pretty well contain Oklahoma better than anyone else had to that point. And then they put up a pretty good performance against Clemson too. I guess Bama doesn't really have that defensively, because their semifinal opponent, Notre Dame, was so, I don't want to say so limited offensively, but they were limited offensively. Right. So if you're going to try to compare the two, I think where it would go against this year's Alabama's team is defensively, where LSU's defense at the end of its season was probably more of a sure thing than Alabama's most recent defense was. But I think you're still kind of splitting hairs there to a degree, more so than you are on the offensive side of things, but you're still splitting hairs, I think. And then finally, this being Alabama's sixth national championship under Nick Saban, Saban's seventh when you include the one at LSU, makes the comparisons between the two borderline unavoidable. So I did a lengthy dive into this. It's posted on TideSports.com right now. It's for subscribers only, I believe. So subscribers to TideSports.com can look at it in its entirety. I'll hit some of the high points and leave the nitty gritty and deep down stuff to the subscribers of TideSports.com. Obviously now both have six national championships at Alabama, and they took somewhat similar paths to get there because they both had to undergo kind of personal and offensive renaissances to continue their dominance. Bear won titles at Bama in 61, 64, and 65, and then they hit a downturn. They lost three games in 68, five games in 69, and five games in 70. Then he learned the wishbone from Daryl Royal, turned the program around, won national championships in 73, 78, and 79. Saban also took on a somewhat famous offensive renaissance, his national title offenses in 2009, 2011, and 2012 are borderline unrecognizable from the offenses that won his three most recent championships in 2015, 2017, and 2020. So they follow pretty similar paths in terms of their current national championships. And then they won the SEC on a somewhat comparable pace as well. So as long as Saban continues to win the SEC in about half of his seasons and then adds one more national championship, he'll be kind of unrivaled in that regard. Their records against the rivals aren't necessarily comparable. Like Bryant's winning percentage against Auburn is about 100 points higher than Nick Saban's, and his winning percentage against LSU is about 60 points higher than Saban's, whereas Saban's winning percentage against Tennessee is a lot better because he's 14-0 against Tennessee. Bryant was 16-7-2 against the Vols. But when you adjust for the eras and you adjust for the style of opponent that Bama was playing in those schools at those times, it more or less evens out. Like I mentioned, Bear's record against Auburn was about 100 winning percentage points better than Saban's currently is. Bear went 19-6 against Auburn. That's a winning percentage of 760. Nick Saban is currently 9-5 against Auburn, 642. But there's a strong case to be made that the Auburn teams that Saban faced have been better than the ones that Bear faced, despite the fact that Bear did most of his coaching against Shug Jordan, for whom Jordan-Hare Stadium is named after. Similar thing happens in LSU. Like Bear's record against LSU is better than Saban's is, but historically speaking, the recent LSU teams have been better than the ones that Bear Bryant faced, and the opposite happens with the Tennessee deal, where Saban is undefeated against pretty hilariously down Tennessee teams, whereas Tennessee was pretty solid for a significant chunk of Bear Bryant's tenure. So the 16-7-2 record there is more understandable than it would be if Saban were to have a comparable winning percentage against Tennessee. And then you look at the legacy of the two. They've obviously both done things for the university and for the city of Tuscaloosa that greatly outweigh what they did on the football field. Saban played a prominent role in the city's recoveries from the tornadoes of April 27, 2011. Bear Bryant played a significant role in integrating the football program. So they both have legacies that live well beyond how many football games they won and lost. So when you run through that tale of the tape, and again, the entire thing with more is on TideSports.com, it's pretty, it's almost shocking how similar they are. Because you would think someone who coached 25 years at a school from 58 to 82 would kind of look different from someone who's coached now 14 years at Bama from 07 to 20. You would think just based on time spent at the institution and the drastically different eras that the two habited, you would think there would be more differences, but they're shockingly similar in a lot of these regards.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is it's tough to differentiate the two, and now we're kind of forced to, right? Because that's the conversation that we're having. And as I tell everyone, Saban had that hip surgery to coach 5 years, not to coach two. So you would think if he does this for another 5 years, maybe there's probably going to be another two or three SEC championships, another national championship or two. And if that comes to pass, then this conversation is over. There is no conversation to be had between the greatness of Nick Saban and the greatness of Bear Bryant. But as it stands right now, it's kind of neck and neck with the two.
Here's the thing. I've always had this opinion that it is very hard to fully appreciate the greatness of something if you don't experience it in real time. You know, I got to see a little bit of Michael Jordan, quite a bit more than a lot of people who like to have these Michael Jordan, LeBron James debates, right? I was still very young, didn't understand the game as much. What was interesting is that ESPN documentary that aired over the summer kind of brought to the forefront a lot of that greatness and did a great job of kind of capturing it. And I think that really started to change a lot of people's opinions as far as the way that he's viewed a lot of the younger generation. If you don't witness, because like you know what the results are in all those Bear Bryant games, right? You know, that was years ago. You can look at the stat sheets, you can look at, but it's, so there's no emotion involved with it. There's no emotional attachment. You watching Alabama come back against Georgia in the 2018 national championship and that walk-off, you know, overtime throw from Tua Tagovailoa, you fully grasp the greatness of it and what they were able to achieve. And that's something that I can't look back at Bear Bryant and associate with anything that I know about him other than just what he's done on paper, right? He's paper to me. As far as the way that I view him, and Saban is more, Nick Saban is more emotional, right? So I think that that is where it gets very difficult for me to try to make the comparison. And there are people, you know, Cecil would be a great one to just, you know, kind of get his opinion on the situation. And he would probably, you know, he wouldn't want to probably go either way if I had to guess. I don't know, maybe be willing to kind of dive in and give an opinion on it. But I mean, you can respect the greatness of both. And it almost seems like if you pick, you're downplaying the other side. And so I understand if you wouldn't want to, but it's people like that and people like, you know, my parents and your parents and people that just were able to at least experience some of both at the very least. Now, one of the big talking points, and I wanted to get your opinion on this, that I find very interesting, you know, with Alabama right now, under Nick Saban, if you want to win a national title, you have to win the national championship. You can't, you know, the national champions aren't crowned after Alabama goes 10-0 in the regular season or 12-0 in the regular season and they go undefeated, which they've done multiple times. Back when Bear Bryant did it, you would get crowned a national champion and then they go out and they'd actually lose you know, championship games or in the postseason. I don't necessarily know that they were championship games necessarily, but they were already national champions by that point. So I think I want to say two of Bear Bryant's were won that way. Does that skew things at all for you? Because that is a major talking point for people that like to say that Nick Saban is the greatest. How impactful do you think that is?
I try not to punish those kinds of things because they can't help that they played the postseason format that they did. Like I'm sure 40 years from now when the playoff has expanded to like, I don't know, 32 teams or something, we'll probably eventually look back at the BCS titles that were won and be like, really? How is that legit? How is that a thing?
Yeah.
So I try not to punish those teams for winning the postseason format that they won. Where my skepticism for the Bear era comes in is just the overall competitiveness and parity of the era. Like it was more difficult for non-traditional powers to pop and have that great team that it was a lot harder for those teams to get upset than it is for Alabama to get upset right now. Like the whole Hugh Freeze Ole Miss thing, that never happens in Bears era. They just don't have that kind of access because of the scholarship limits or lack thereof being what they are and television exposure being what it is, like it was a lot harder for those programs to recruit since they had almost no regional or national presence that schools like Alabama and Nebraska at the time had. I think it's a lot harder to be dominant in this era than it was back then. So I don't know that the postseason format gets me, but I think just the general nature of the eras makes it harder to be this dominant now than it was back then.
Yeah, and I'm kind of – the scholarship limit is a huge point. And for people that don't understand why that's so important, back then, from what I understand, like I said, didn't live it, but from what I understand, Alabama could go out and offer talented guys and bring them in with just to keep them away from other schools. It wasn't like, okay, I think this kid's going to contribute to us or help us win a national championship necessarily, but he fits, you know, Auburn's scheme extremely well. We don't want them getting him. Let's go offer him. We're Alabama. They're probably going to want to come here, and that way Auburn can't get their hands on him. And you could deal with as many guys as you wanted to. And so that, you know, the competitiveness of it was a little bit, you know, less. You know, if you gave anybody that wanted to come to Alabama, that Alabama was willing to offer, if there was no scholarship limits, I mean, how many guys do you think Alabama turns away right there kind of at the end as you're starting to crunch numbers? You'll have them back off of certain guys, even talented guys. You know, if it's a guy that, like, you're like, yeah, I like him as a high school player, but schematically, man, I'm just not sure that he really fits what we're trying to do defensively or offensively. But if you could go out there and say, well, you never know, we don't have a limit, why not give the guy a chance, see if he fits, and it keeps, you know, Clemson from having him. That and Clemson's risen to the point where they kind of would be able to overcome that. But I'm saying Clemson might not even be Clemson if that was still the rule. So that's an extremely important distinction between the two things. Right now, things are designed to be a lot more even. And people are still upset. People are calling for freaking Nick Saban for the NCAA to pay Nick Saban to go away, to make it more competitive. That's where we're at as far as his greatness. They've figured out no way on the field. New rules have been implemented. Just nothing's been able to slow the guy down. Recruiting standpoint, from the standpoint of, you know, adjusting, you talk about the types of guys that he recruited back in 2009 and 10 and 11 and 12 and the way that the game has evolved. A lot of coaches, the greatness of coaches, that's where they get in trouble because they're so stubborn that they don't want to change what has always worked for them and been successful, or they don't want to change enough for them to be able to stay competitive. And that's what you've talked about. The game's passed them by. With Nick Saban, you talk about going from being just a dominant defensive team, quote unquote, game manager, quarterback, strong run game, to slinging the ball 50 times a game, regardless of who's at quarterback, then putting up numbers, wide receivers for days, still have that good run game, but it's more played off of, you know, the run game is opened up by the dominant passing game. The defense is giving up a ton of points, and yet a defensive minded head coach has been able to adjust, and he, not saying that he's accepted that, it's very frustrating, but he even isn't holding his own defense to the same standard as some Alabama fans are, because he accepts the fact that, you know, this is a different era, this is a different time, and it's much more difficult to be to the same dominance level defensively as you were 10 years ago. And so he's trying to get back to that point as much as he possibly can, but he's a lot more realistic with where the game's going. And his ability to adjust, I think, is what is different to me. I don't know, like I said, I don't know enough about Bear Bryant to be able to say, okay, what kind of adjustments did he make over the course of his career to stay, as you know, to stay dominant and relevant? I couldn't really answer that question, so it's tough for me. And that's why I feel there are very few people that can actually speak on this subject with any sort of certainty. And I'll continue to reiterate the lack of seeing the greatness and experiencing the emotional aspect of it. You know, I think that makes people a lot more biased. There are so many people nowadays that just pick the people that they're seeing right now in the moment because that's all they know. And you're kind of imagining, I don't understand how anybody's better than this. You look at Nick Saban right now and what he's been able to do and how just not fun college football is for anybody that is not an Alabama fan. And you say, you know, if you're one of those people, you're looking at this and be like, I don't understand how Bear Bryant's even in this conversation. I get that he won a lot of national championships, but there's no way this was this miserable back then. It probably was, but I just, there's a lot of aspects to this debate, and it's not something that I think that we'll ever be able to reach a definitive conclusion on. I think from a national championship standpoint, and the fact that Nick Saban's now at 7, he'll probably be kind of accepted by the masses as being the greatest of all time just for that specific reason. But when you start getting into the deep dive of it and trying to compare, I think there's arguments to be made for both coaches. And we can sit here and acknowledge what's crazy is that we're having the debate of the two greatest college football coaches of all time, and they both were at Alabama. What are the chances of that?
You would think next to none.
Yeah, you would think so. Especially when another team like LSU had Nick Saban, and just the way that it worked out, it's very possible that he was going to build this right there in Baton Rouge. And instead takes that, trip to Miami for a couple of years and then comes back and then he builds it out at Alabama. You know, just the chances of that happening. What's crazy is that you had the Bear Bryant era, and during that gap, that huge gap between Bear Bryant and Nick Saban, you have, there were a lot of people that was like, those are the glory years. We'll never get back there. You get Gene Stallings winning a national title in 92, and you say that's fantastic. You weren't expecting him to go on the kind of run, any sort of run like Bear Bryant did. But then all of a sudden it gets kind of recaptured again, and now it's every bit as much so, if not even more, maybe. And just, I'll tell you right now, not trying to be pessimistic for Alabama fans, but the chances of it happening a third time to the same program, the three greatest college football coaches of all time, that'd be catching lightning in a bottle three times. And the fact they did it twice was pretty special.
I saw this what if tweeted during the playoff games over the weekend, especially the Saints game. What happens if Drew Brees gets medically cleared in Miami and Drew Brees goes to Miami, joins Nick Saban, and does his Drew Brees thing there in Miami as opposed to New Orleans? Then is Nick Saban still the head coach of the Dolphins right now? Probably with a couple of Super Bowl rings on his finger, and Alabama's doing God knows what?
And that's a great question, and that's something that I think – there are so many what ifs. Just the combination of factors that had to take place to get Nick Saban to Alabama. Just the timing of it, the fact that Mal Moore wouldn't accept no for an answer, the fact that Rich Rodriguez, the reason that Mal Moore went to Miami that second time and said, okay, I can't come back without Nick Saban, was Rich Rodriguez, and what had happened with that. If Paul Feinbaum doesn't say that stuff about Rich Rodriguez's wife, there's just so many different things that if it doesn't happen, are we having this conversation? And that makes it pretty, the speculation pretty cool. And that's got to upset a lot of people that's not an Alabama fan. But I think there is something to be said. Now, I remember talking to Coach Saban one time. My best friend in high school, William Ming, ended up playing at Alabama for, 5 years, I guess, 4 years, one of the two. And, won a couple of national championships. And when he was going through a recruiting process, I was with him and we were talking to Coach Saban. And I remember him bringing up the fact that one of the aspects that he liked about college was, and he was talking to William and he said, it was right after Mark Ingram's, first season. And he was expected to be the starting running back in 2009 and ended up winning the Heisman Trophy that year. But this was before that. But he essentially said, it doesn't matter what Mark does this year, you're going to get the same thing that he is, and that is a scholarship, a full paid scholarship. And he talked about, every day people knocking on his door, players with the Miami Dolphins wanting more money, feel like they deserve more, felt like they were being disrespected because this wasn't happening or that wasn't happening. And it's like he had to constantly say that's the GM's job, so there was this headache with money and the greed of men that Nick Saban had to deal with in the NFL that I don't think he liked. Plus, you have to work in tandem with somebody else. At Alabama, it's like Nick Saban decides, okay, who are we going to get? Okay, we're going to go get these guys. And you go and you offer them, and of course you have to recruit them. It's not like the NFL where you just go get to pick them and they have to come to your team regardless. But that also means that when they're coming to your team,
they want to be there. You know, there are guys that get drafted to, you know, Rolando McClain straight up told the back then the Oakland Raiders, hey, that's really far away, going all the way to California. Don't draft me. And they drafted him and he was miserable out there. And so like the aspect of getting to go out and recruit, like you get guys that want to be there, but you also kind of get to go and pick and choose who you want in a lot of ways. In the NFL, it's what you want, but it's also what your GM wants. It's the decision making that he is as far as building the roster goes, and you don't have the final say, and you have things that end up happening. Team doctors don't approve certain guys' shoulders, you know, like a Drew Brees or something like that, that kind of prevents it from happening. It's just so I think that he was probably going to end up back on in the college game eventually based off of the things that I do know, but I think the timing of it, I do think that if he would have stuck around the NFL, he was going to figure out a way to make it work and become successful doing it. And, but you know, if he had Drew Brees and he had a lot more success early, he could have stuck around in the NFL for a lot longer. And by that time, Alabama would have went out and probably hired somebody else and the timing might've not been right. And he could have ended up, you know, somewhere else. So very interesting how that whole thing worked out as well. I don't know how we got off on this topic, but that's a fascinating conversation.
Well, we hope y'all enjoyed one last look back at the national championship season that was, because when we come back to the mics later in the week, we'll be turning the page to the 2021 football season. We'll look at the roster turnover, the coaching staff turnover, or at least the turnover that has happened to that point, what it means for Alabama, where it goes from there, and then probably, if we have time, a brief look at the decisions yet to be made, like Brian Robinson Jr., for instance. We'll see if we gain clarity on that situation and others in between now and then. If not, we'll let you know where what to keep your eye out for in the days and weeks to come. Until then, we appreciate y'all listening to the Bama Beat Podcast.